The following interview contains some colorful language, very familiar to people working in marketing and sales, but probably not suitable for children. Listener discretion is advised.
G'day there, this is Adam Ashton, co-author of The Shit They Never Taught You, What You Can Learn From Books, and you are listening to a special bonus episode of the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, where each week I publish an interview with the author of a new marketing or sales book. This, however, is a special bonus episode, a little something extra for you that's out of the ordinary. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything linkable on this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. And since you're a listener to the Marketing Book Podcast and I read every book featured on the show, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or any other resource I know of for whatever challenge you're facing, send me a LinkedIn connection invite with a message indicating that you're a listener so I won't mistake you for a spammer and ignore you, and I will do my best to get you pointed in the right direction. All right, let the bonus begin. Today, we welcome Adam Ashton for a special bonus episode to talk about the book he has co-authored with Adam Jones, The Shit They Never Taught You, What You Can Learn From Books. Adam Ashton is the co-host of the What You Will Learn podcast and is an account manager at AndMine, a full-service digital agency based in Melbourne and Sydney, Australia. So from the What You Will Learn podcast on iTunes, here's how they describe it. We're Adam and Adam, two Aussie blokes that love reading great books. Each week, we share the best bits from the best books and interview the world's top authors. The books we cover can help you improve every area of your life, from your health to your wealth, from your relationships to your mindset. You'll learn to pick up healthier habits and drop the ones that are holding you back. We put the world's best ideas within your reach for a fraction of the time it would take to read the full book. And from the About page on their podcast website, Adam describes himself this way. After bouncing around between university degrees, physiotherapy, economics, finance, then bouncing around between jobs, corporate banking, transportation and logistics, digital marketing, I found a lot of the answers I was searching for in books. My favorite books have helped me understand myself better and understand the world better. I've learned about how to test our business ideas, how to better understand other people, and how the world actually is, not how I think it should be. Through reading books and turning them into podcast episodes, I've developed my confidence, my speaking abilities, and I have been consistently following through on a creative project over many years. And, interesting fact, his book and podcast are alcohol-related. He and his co-author and podcast co-host met while working together in a pub. Adam, congratulations on The Shit They Never Taught You, and welcome to this special bonus episode of the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I've been a long-time listener. I work in marketing. I read books about marketing. I've written a little bit about marketing as well, so I'm glad to be here on the Marketing Book Podcast.
Well, if you're a long-time listener of the Marketing Book Podcast, that automatically means that you're probably a very attractive person.
I have heard those statistics, and I'm glad to be part of the small minority of the population that are extremely good looking.
Yeah, you are. Now, seriously, if you look on this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com, you will see that Adam Ashton is not an unattractive man. In fact, a recent author I interviewed from New York City, he told me that the Ford Modeling Agency, pretty much all they're doing now is first determining, do these prospective models listen to the Marketing Book Podcast? If so, then they bring them in for an interview. So now, Adam, you are also heir to the Ashton cigar fortune. Is that correct?
It's actually the Ashton guitar fortune. They've got a brand of guitars and amplifiers. Unfortunately, no relation to this Ashton, but I'm happy to claim either one of those, guitars or cigars.
Well, I know more about cigars for all the wrong reason, but anyway, they're very fine cigars. They're not a sponsor of this show, but if they'd like to be, just a little, just putting that out there for the nice folks at Ashton. So I want to read a couple of things from the beginning of the book, because this is such a special book, and very different. And I want to read these parts that underscore that I think you and your co-author Adam and I, we're all brothers from different mothers, because we our lives have been enriched immeasurably by books. And looking back, I'm a little older than you guys. The right book at the right time has changed the trajectory of my career and, well, certainly my life. So I want to read from page 5 here. Limitless, starring Bradley Cooper, is a story about an ordinary bloke named Eddie Mora. At the beginning of the film, he is an all-around loser. He gets dumped by his girlfriend, has bags under his eyes, and is an ignorant alcoholic. Eddie's life is an absolute mess. Through a series of events, Eddie gets hold of a drug called NZT-47. He pops a pill as he walks up the stairs to his apartment. In an argument with his landlord, he sees himself in an out-of-body experience. He thinks, "I was blind, but now I see." He opens the door to his apartment, and it's a disgusting mess. Interestingly, the first thing Eddie does is clean the dishes, empty the trash can, and tidy his house. With his newfound intelligence, he played the stock market and made bank. He goes from a lazy bum to a supercharged genius. At first, he was in awe at the power of this drug, but he soon realized its effects were quite simple. It made him clear on what he needed to do and how to do it. NZT-47 gave Eddie the missing pieces of the puzzle. He now holds all of the ingredients required to achieve success in the modern world. He's happy, rich, hot, smart, a weapon in bed, and doing meaningful work. Would you take that pill? This is an important question we all have to ask ourselves. Most people spend their whole life convinced a pill like this does not exist. If you want a similar transformation to Eddie, there is a simple prescription available. Adam Ashton, what is it?
Well, if you think about what $50 can buy you today, it's probably a few rounds of beers at the pub. It might be an Uber ride in or out of the city. It might be buying a pay-per-view fight on TV. But for us, that magic pill that we would rather spend our $50 on is books. Books we feel like have the answer to many of life questions, if not all. If you find the right book by the right person at the right time, you can really find the answer to whatever you're looking for. For us, it just means that we're tapping into the brains, I guess, of some of the smartest people of all time who have packaged up decades of work and research and studies and experience and just put it all into one handy little package. It takes you, you know, a few hours to read and you know, maybe a week's worth of coffees. And you can really tap in to find those missing pieces, find out what you need to do, find out how you need to do it. And so for us, that drug is books.
And I have discovered that as well. And I just, as I said before, I can't agree with you any more than I already do, because I've seen the impact and I've seen how it's affected others. Now, I can't resist. There's a few other things I want to read from the book. You write, "Books are the most undervalued commodity on the planet." And you go on to write, "Telling someone to read more books is like telling someone to make more money or lose weight. Wanting to do something and actually doing it are two totally different ball games. We're all busy with our jobs, our friends, our kids, plus we have to get some sleep, clean the dishes, go for a jog, and of course, we have to find the time for some Netflix and chill. All of the book recommendations you're getting keep piling up on the nightstand, but when you hit the hay after a long day of dealing with life's obligations, you can't seem to find a good book that will tell you what you need to know to improve your life. There are so many amazing books out there, but there's also a lot of crap. Some academics know their shit but can't make it digestible for the layperson like you or I. Some authors hit it big with a viral TED Talk or an appearance on Oprah, and a publisher handed them a juicy check to turn their 18-minute spiel into a 300-page book, which meant they fluffed it up with a lot of junk. Others just regurgitate the same old platitudes that add no value to your life. If you can trudge your way through the swamp of crap books to find some gold on the other side, your life could change in an instant. Imagine reading about a brand new idea that was told in an engaging and entertaining way. Imagine taking the best nuggets of gold from the greatest minds in history and applying it to your own world. That would be a truly amazing pill." And I'm sorry, there's just one other thing I want to read. You go on to write, "Have you ever learned something so simple, yet so profound it made you think, why the hell didn't someone tell me this earlier? As avid book readers, it happens to us every couple of weeks, ranging from simple ideas about how to save more money to more complex ideas about how the human brain plays tricks on us. There are a whole host of eye-opening ideas we were never taught when we were growing up. For our entire adult lives, we've been searching for magic pills that could change the trajectory and our ultimate destination of our lives, and we found them hidden inside books. We've packaged up the biggest ideas from over 100 of the greatest minds on the planet. The Shit They Never Taught You is a compilation of exactly that. The Shit They Never Taught You. And so today, before the interview, I posted a picture of your book and got a big reaction. And one, and actually another author, she wrote, I assume this is just edition one. When is book 2 through 7 coming out? And I had to laugh and say, well, this book has 677 pages. And part of that is why this is a bonus episode, because I didn't read the whole thing. Normally, I read the whole book. And believe it or not, I'm actually going to go back because I started – you guys are good. I started reading other sections that weren't related to marketing, and I have a feeling this is going to be one of those coffee table books where I'm going to be – this is so good, I'm going to actually start reading this rather than looking at a Facebook news feed.
Oh, nice. Well, that's a win. That's a huge compliment.
Definitely. So you write, this is no ordinary book. The Shit They Never Taught You is divided into 9 parts, 32 lessons, 115 chapters, and as I said, it's 677 pages. So with apologies to you and your co-author, Adam, you've got these. I'm gonna describe my best understanding of what the different sections are, but please feel free to correct me. I read the intro to each section. So part one is getting your shit together, which I gather was more about thinking about life. What is it you want? And part two was your career journey, which is fairly self-explanatory. Part three is run your own show, which I gather was more about what is it you really want to do in your life? Mm. And then part four is marketing to the masses, which we're going to talk about. Part five is Top Dog Toolbox, which was very much about leadership. When you start to become the top dog, you need to learn. That's a very popular category of books. Part six is Making Bank, about financial management and some of the key points to understand about that. Part seven is Human Behavior, the Good, the Bad, and the Dumb, which if you come back, maybe we could just cover that section because that's so applicable. And several of the sections in there were books that I'm familiar with, and I think even a few that I may have had on the show. Part eight, The Past, Present, and Future, which looked like it was very much about history, but also the planet and where the world is going and our place in it and how it's actually – we're actually quite early on in human history. And then part nine, The Non-Wanker Philosophy. And all you people in the U.S. that don't know what that means, I'll let you look that up on Urban Dictionary. But that has to do with philosophy. And the reason you say non-wanker is because my experience is that philosophy is often misunderstood. It's not always very well taught. It's not very well understood. But actually, this is a time when it's extremely important to get at it. So it was, you could have said a non-BS approach to philosophy. So that's the kind of the book structure. So if it's all right, I wanted to go straight to part four, and that's marketing to the masses. And there are three lessons and, gosh, about a dozen chapters, I think. And so the three lessons are powerful positioning, and the next one is spreading the word, and the third of the three lessons is the plans of the puppet masters. You all have this wonderful quote at the beginning of every lesson, and I'd like to read it for each of these three, and then we can, as quickly as you like, we can walk through the different books that form the part of that lesson, and you could share with us what things you learned from those books. And some of these books have been on the Marketing Book Podcast, and some of them are, but they're all really well-known books. So the first one is Powerful Positioning on page 355. You write, you could have the best product or service ever invented, and it would mean absolutely nothing if nobody knew about it. It doesn't matter what value you create. Without marketing, no business can survive. So the first chapter really is titled The Golden Circle, and it's inspired by the really famous book Start With Why by Simon Sinek. What's interesting to me, Adam, is hundreds and hundreds of books, and you picked these. And it's a really interesting selection, and I enjoyed reading this whole section of the book. What is it about Start With Why? And keep in mind, a lot of people listening may not have read each of these books. What is it that you found so interesting and relevant to you about this book?
Well, as you mentioned, we've got 677 pages worth of stuff that covers personal development, career, business, marketing, personal finance, leadership, philosophy, history, psychology. I got to be honest, I reckon we could have filled 677 pages just with marketing stuff. I feel like this is probably the one part where I feel like we could have just had so much more. We could have had infinitely more. There's just so much great stuff out there. We went for these, the ones we picked. So the powerful positioning, I guess, is a bit of a setup of marketing overall. And then spreading the word is more about word of mouth and spreading ideas. And then the plans of puppet masters is more about not necessarily the underhanded stuff, but some of the stuff that you probably don't even realize that is influencing you all the time. Mm-hmm. So this first part, the powerful positioning, we start with the golden circle. We couldn't not feature Start With Why. I think it's the third biggest TED Talk of all time. It's top five anyway.
Yeah.
Simon Sinek, extremely, extremely popular, extremely well known. And we thought, well, we can't start anywhere else other than this.
To add to that, Adam, that book has been mentioned so much in the hundreds of books I've had on my show. So you almost couldn't not include it. And I was delighted to see you kicked off the whole section with that.
Yeah, I think this was just the one that I guess that we tried to use to set up the whole frame of marketing, where you've got the golden circle. He talks about what, how, and why. So the what is quite obvious. You know, that's the basic thing you do. You build this gadget, or you make websites, or you sell pens, or whatever it is that you do. That's quite obvious. Everybody, well, hopefully everybody knows what they do. The next sort of ring inside the onion, going a little bit deeper, is how. And the how is, you know, why the reason why people should be choosing you and your product. How do you do it that makes you better than others? But then the deepest layer of this golden circle, like the center of the bullseye, is why. That's your purpose. You know, why does your company exist? Why do you get out of bed in the morning? Why do you get out of bed in the morning? And why the hell should anybody else care? The problem is most people, they start with what, and that's pretty much where they finish. They say, hey, we sell pens. Come and buy a pen off us. Which is not that good marketing. Mm-hmm. The best marketers start with why. They start at the middle. They start about why they do things. By the time they get through why and then how and then what, you're pretty much ready to buy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you talk about a company I wasn't familiar with who made MP3 players. It was called Creative. And they were very good MP3 players. And you write, we make great MP3 players. They are beautifully designed, simple to use, and user-friendly. You want to buy one? And in contrast, Apple said, everything we do, we believe. Now, so Apple started with why and then worked into how and what. Apple would have said, everything we do, we believe in challenging the status quo. We believe in thinking differently. The way we challenge the status quo is by making our products beautifully designed, simple to use, and user-friendly. And we happen to make great music players. Want to buy one? So there you go.
It's a totally different proposition. I wish we could claim that as well. I think all credit there goes to Simon Sinek for pulling these out. But it's very different. Like Creative, they actually beat Apple to the punch. They had a better MP3 player first. But the problem was they just didn't market it properly. Mm-hmm. Compare that to Apple, who marketed it. Everybody knows, you know, the first iPod, 1,000 songs in your pocket. It was great marketing. And, you know, based all around challenging the status quo and thinking differently, that was their why. By the time you say, hey, we got a music player, do you want 1,000 songs in your pocket? You're pretty much already bought.
Yes. So let's go to the next one, which is the chapter is, this is on page 359, First to Mind. And it's inspired by the 22 Immutable Laws of Marketing by Al Ries and Jack Trout, same fellows that wrote Positioning, The Battle for Your Mind, one of the greatest marketing books. I think it was in the mid-80s it came out. And you have a quote on here that says, marketing is a battle of perceptions, not products, with lots of great advice. Talk about some of these laws and what folks should be doing.
Well, the law of being first to mind, it's surprising that often being first is better than being better. It sounds a little bit weird to say, but being first is often better than being better. In that, Neil Armstrong was the first man to walk on the moon. Who was the second? Roger Bannister was the first man to break the 4-minute mile. Who was the second? George Washington was the first president of the U.S. Who was the second?
John Adams.
You got that one. That's one out of three. It's very easy to think of who the first was, but it's a lot harder to think of who the second was. Often the first person gets a lot of the benefits of that first mover advantage. As we said, though, sometimes Creative was first with the MP3 player. They didn't necessarily win. That probably comes into some of the other problems that they messed up. But often being first is better than being better.
Right, and for those people saying, yeah, but I'm already in a category where we're not first, you're right. If you can't be first in a category, set up a new category. Give an example of that.
Yeah, exactly. Well, the first billionaire was John D. Rockefeller. I think a lot of people would probably know that name. But then if you think of there's another billionaire who wasn't the first billionaire, wasn't even the second billionaire, wasn't probably even in the first 100 or the first 1,000 billionaires, but you probably know her name. Her name was Sarah Blakely. She started Spanx. And the reason you probably know her name is that she was the youngest ever self-made female billionaire. So we've got, the category here is, you've got self-made, you've got female, you're creating a new subcategory within the broader category of billionaire. And even if you can't be the first ever billionaire, you can be the first, the first youngest ever self-made female billionaire. So of course, if you want to be a billionaire, you might need to create a couple of new categories. But if you're in whatever industry you're in, I'm sure you can find some subcategories, some smaller niches that you can create a category to be first in.
Yes, you're right. Michelob was able to claim market share when they became the first category of high-priced beer. Miller Lite came in and was the first in the category of light beer. Even after Miller claimed the first light beer, Amstel Light still found success when they became the first imported light beer. So let's go to the next one, product marketing, which is inspired by Perennial Seller by Ryan Holiday. I had the honor of interviewing him, and you write, each new work competes for customers with everything that came before it and everything that will come after it. So talk about what it was about Perennial Seller, which is just such a brilliant book, that inspired you. And let me just add, towards the end of that chapter, you write, we need to flip the old equation on its head and channel most of our effort and energy into making something great. And that's in contrast to what you write about earlier, saying, look, we can sell a piece of crap if we just market it hard enough. I loved it, because yeah, those days are over.
Yeah, the old school world probably was, you make whatever you make, then just buy a whole bunch of TV ads. If you've got the biggest budget for marketing, as in you can spend the most on TV ads, then you probably we're going to win. Whereas now there's just so much competition. There's none of those sort of easy ways, quote unquote, easy ways to just get in front of people and interrupt them and convince them to buy your stuff. It's going to be a lot harder. So the equation shifts from, 10% product development, 90% marketing. It probably flips the other way, 90% focus on your product and then 10% marketing. But a lot of this is to do with building the best possible product that you possibly can. It's not the cheap and easy MVP, which of course is a good starting point. The Perennial Seller says, focus all your efforts and energy, especially at the start, on building this awesome product. So if you think of books, there's hundreds of books published every day. You're not just competing with those books. You're also competing with the book that got published yesterday, or the book that got published last week, or the book that got published last year, or the book that got published 100 years ago. If someone's going to buy one book, they can choose out of any book that's ever been published. So it's going to be pretty tough to crack through. So in order to crack through, you better write a bloody good book.
Right. And it's just so funny how people have that somewhat dated mindset of, you know, just buy ads, just make noise, just interrupt people. We can, you know, we can polish it up. And the sad or the wonderful truth is that people don't really believe what companies say for the most part. It's very low on the trust meter. But the way you run your business has a lot more to do with marketing now than it used to. The way you treat your employees, the kind of people you hire, and how you train them. You know, it's funny, where I live here in Virginia, in Norfolk, Virginia, there's several breweries, and small microbreweries, and there was this one that I was familiar with, and I think I'd been there a couple times over the years, and have had some of their beer. I've done extensive product testing for them. at any rate, I hadn't been there now in a couple of years, but I started seeing all this stuff on social media about how horrible they were treating their employees and how awful they were treating women who worked there. And it was all coming out. And no amount of, you know, marketing or spin is going to help them. So that's such a great example for me of, you know, it's how you run your company. We're all living in somewhat clearer glass houses now. And that's why I'm so suspicious of books about branding that presume that building a brand is something your marketing department does. It doesn't. Mm. You know, it has to do more with as Jeff Bezos would say, your brand is really what other people say about you when you're not in the room. And there's even a study from about 12 years ago from McKinsey that talked about how over 2/3 of all communication about companies is not made by a company anymore. Mm. So, you know, your product becomes very important. But we're not saying it's just the product. We're not saying just the best product wins. The next one was service marketing, inspired by Selling the Invisible by Harry Beckwith. And I have not read that one. So thanks. You've just added to my reading list tenfold.
Another book to your list.
Yeah.
This is a good one.
This is a good one. Well, I have heard about it. And there's a secret list I have of books that I'm embarrassed to admit that I haven't read. And that's, of course, one of them. You're right. Don't charge by the hour, charge by the year. And what I wanted to ask you about is where you say on page 368, what are you really selling? I found this interesting. You say for most expert services, such as lawyers, accountants, doctors, engineers, think that their clients are buying expertise. But most prospects for these complex services cannot evaluate the quality of the expertise. So prospects look for proxies instead. And you write, clients are experts at knowing if they feel valued. In most professional services, you're not really selling expertise. Your ability to do the job is assumed, so you're actually selling a relationship. I hadn't read that book, but I was very interested to see that. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, well, service marketing contrasts to the previous chapter on product marketing. Services are so different to products. It seems so basic to say that services and products are different, but the way that people treat product marketing and service marketing isn't different enough. As we say here with this, the service marketing, you don't know if your tax accountant could have squeezed an extra couple of bucks out of your return, or you don't know if that consultant could have added an extra 10% better insight to what they came up with, or you don't really know if the person that you've paid to do this expert service, you're not an expert yourself, so you don't really know if they're doing the absolute best job possible, and really you don't really know how much that job is worth either, because it's quite hard to price a service. So what we do as customers is we defer to other things. We look to the relationship. We look to, do they answer your phone call or do they let it go to voicemail? Do they reply to your email within the day or do they reply later that week? Just those simple things of the relationship side of a business, especially a service business, can really make or break you. If you feel like you're not being valued as a customer, if you feel like they're ignoring your calls, ignoring your emails, they're not quick, they're not efficient, they're not responsive, you're probably going to get up and move somewhere else, regardless of how good their work was. You don't know how good their work was, so you're just looking purely at the relationship side of it.
Yes, and then you go on to talk about why you shouldn't charge for your time. You should try to charge for your value. And there are some great books about that out there. Let's go to the next lesson, spreading the word. You write, great marketing in the 20th century. Oh, this is perfect. It's just what we were talking about. Great marketing in the 20th century used to mean buying billboards and TV ads. Enough people would see the ads and buy your product that you could afford to buy more ads. But 20th century marketing is just so last century. The way to win today isn't about getting your product in front of a lot of people, but getting it in front of the right people. And Adam, as a former New York City ad man, you know, even in the 1980s, it really was about the client's budget. We had a captive audience, and we could more or less shout at people, and they would do what we told them. It worked beautifully. But if it still worked, I'd still be doing that. But I'm not. But there are at least a generation of business people out there that think that they still have that muscle memory, or they think that's how it works. So let's go to concentrate the forces. And this is something that comes up with me about every week when I'm trying to help a client or a prospect understand that they can't be all things to all people. And this was inspired by the marketing classic, Crossing the Chasm, by Jeffrey Moore. I think the last edition of that he's done was 2014. Very well done. He's updated it over the years. Quoting from his book, entering the mainstream market is an act of burglary, of breaking and entering, of deception, often even stealth. And you actually conclude the chapter by talking about the Allied invasion of Normandy in World War II. Go.
Yeah. As we said, you know, mass marketing or mainstream, trying to capture the mainstream market used to be, you know, shouting all things to all people, just trying to tell as many people as possible about your offer. Whereas now, you can't really afford to do that. There's just so many people, so many different channels. You can't literally be everywhere. You can't just say to every single person on earth, tell them about your offer. The important thing is to treat different people differently. Some people are going to be extremely receptive to your idea at first, as in when you first launch it. They're the innovators and the early adopters. Some people are only going to be interested once they've seen proof that other people are using it and that it works. So you almost have to ignore those people at first. And as we say, that we've got to concentrate the forces. And in terms of the Battle of Normandy, if you just tried to go out there and fight all the possible wars, you're going to be stretched very thin.
Well, the entire Atlantic wall that Hitler had. They picked a very narrow piece of beach to go in.
And they literally picked one beach. So if you can concentrate all your forces on one beach, if you can capture that beach, then at least you've got a foot in the door, and that's when you can start from there. If you try to crack every single area, which is, I guess, the metaphor for trying to get everybody to buy from you, you're going to lose the battle. If you can concentrate on one part, capture one very, very small segment of the audience, then you can start to spread from there.
And as someone who's an amateur military historian who's very interested in that topic, I was delighted to see an example in here that I've sometimes tried to use with people by explaining, wait a minute, let's establish a beachhead here. And I'm not sure a lot of people even understand what a beachhead, it's a military term. So let's go to another one based on Contagious by Jonah Berger. And I've been able to interview him twice, but I didn't interview him about Contagious, but that's a great book. You write, virality isn't born. And this is a chapter on social transmission. And the thing that's so interesting is that this, you really focus in on people share things because of what it says about them, not because they're trying to help other people. Do I have that right?
Yeah, it's absolutely crazy. This is one of those things that really smacked me over the head, that really made me notice the things that I was saying. If you say, oh, I went to the mountains. I went to the snow this weekend and went skiing. You should go. You should check it out. You're not telling the other person that they should go skiing. You're just wanting to tell everybody that you went skiing. It's a totally different proposition. You might think that you're trying to help them by suggesting a cool activity, but really you're just showing off that you did a cool activity. And so this sort of ties in, this flows on from the beachhead that we're talking about, that once you've captured one small, tiny section of the types of people that you're trying to sell to, you can then start to spread it almost like a virus. I think we're all pretty familiar with how viruses spread in the current climate. But it's like the marketing equivalent of the virus. So once a couple of people catch this virus, it can start to spread. So this is really your best way to get everybody to buy isn't to market to everybody, but to market to that one small vocal minority and get them to do the rest of the marketing by spreading your product or service or idea.
Yes, you're right. We tell people things not because we believe it will help them, but because it makes us look good. Come on, people. Be honest. Be honest about that. So let's go to the next one, another classic, Purple Cow by Seth Godin. And this is a chapter on Be Remarkable. And it also kind of takes me back to what we just talked about in terms of product and perennial seller. He wrote one famous line from his book is, transform your business by being remarkable. So talk about this purple cow. And you know, it's still not adopted very well because it's not as easy as buying an ad.
No way. I guess it ties into a lot of all the things that we've already discussed around making a great product and targeting that small segment and spreading via word of mouth. What this sort of adds, the cherry on top, the thing that you really need to do is to be remarkable. You know, Seth tells a story of they were driving through the countryside in France and their family, being city slickers from New York, didn't get out to the country too often. But then they drove past a cow and they were just so impressed. They're like, oh my goodness, it's a cow. But then, of course, the second cow was still a little bit exciting, but they kept seeing this brown cow after brown cow. By about the sixth brown cow they'd seen, it was no longer that exciting. Even though initially it was quite new to them, they kind of got sick of all these brown cows. But then Seth said, well, imagine if you were driving, you pull around a corner and just over the mountain, you see a purple cow. Now, that would really be something worth talking about and something worth telling people about. And so that's what Seth is trying to say, is that you need to, you know, if you want people to talk about your product, if you want to spread like a virus through social transmission, through word of mouth, you need to have something worth spreading. You need to create something worth telling other people about. And that's what he says is the purple cow. You need to build some kind of element of that purple cow into your product if you want people to tell other people.
And speaking of Seth Godin and cows, because my head is filled with worthless trivia, he's originally from Buffalo, New York.
There you go.
But he lives in the New York City metro area now. Now, I was wondering if you could say one thing about this line. You say, you explain the opposite of remarkable is very good.
Yeah, you might think that remarkable is what we're going for, worthy of remark, as in you want to remark, you want to tell other people about it. You'd think that remarkable is one end of the spectrum, and the other end of the spectrum is crap or bad or useless. But he says, actually, the opposite of remarkable is very good, which sounds a little bit counterintuitive. You would think that very good is ever so slightly below remarkable, but he says, no, it's the opposite. You don't tell people about very good. You don't tell people, oh, I had a very good pizza last night, or I had a very good pasta. You tell people if you had the best pasta you've ever had, or you tell people that you had this pasta. You had this pasta where they mixed prawns and chilies, but they also threw in some pear and some cardamom spice. I was just trying to think of on the fly what the most bizarre thing possible was, that you're going to tell people about either the best ever or something unique and different. You're not going to tell people about the great spaghetti bolognese that was your standard mix. You're going to tell them only things that are completely remarkable, worthy of remark.
And as we record this, it's about 8 a.m. where you are in Australia. And it's, is that right? It's about 8 a.m.? No, it's 9 a.m.
Yeah.
And it's
9 a.m. now. We just hit 9, yeah.
7 p.m. where I am on the East Coast of the United States. And I'm kind of hungry. And now you're torturing me. I haven't had dinner. So
I would avoid the prawn and pear concoction that I just made up on the fly. Maybe go for the safe option instead.
You know, were you ever a waiter?
I was a bartender. Never quite a waiter though.
I was a waiter at one time. But I never had a job at a restaurant where I would come in with a well-rehearsed description of the special and how the chef prepared it. My specialty was low-end restaurants. It was a niche. You know, it was my beachhead. But as you were describing it there, I thought, man, you sound like a professional. Maybe you go to restaurants a lot, but that sounded delicious, and I would have bought it if it were the special. So
maybe I've got a new calling. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, calling. You've had a kind of an adventurous life, and are you still in your 20s?
Yeah, 28 now.
Okay.
Still just clinging to the 20s.
Yeah. Yeah. So I mean, there's plenty of other things you'll be doing, but anyway, well, let's go to the last lesson. The plans of the puppet masters. You write, the best marketers know how to pull the strings of a human being. Small changes to your marketing messages can have massive impacts on how it is received. If you understand what game some deceptive marketers are playing, you can cut yourself loose from their strings. Or, if you're that way inclined, you can become a puppet master yourself and supercharge your marketing. Now, Adam, as a marketer, when you say if you understand what games some deceptive marketers are playing, you can cut yourself loose from their strings, I'm going to have to ask you to surrender your secret marketer card. You're no longer – no, I'm kidding. But seriously, I'm joking, folks. And a group of people from the agency world like you and I are, they can be some of the best BS artists. There is no secret sauce. So if you're looking at hiring an agency, don't believe the ones that think that they've got like the Ark of the Covenant. Mm. They're ready to.
Definitely.
Yeah. Ask them if they've read this book.
Yeah. exactly.
So the last one we're going to talk about is Weapons of Influence. And it's inspired by the book Influence by Robert Cialdini. And this book, this whole chapter is the whole lesson. And I couldn't think of a better book. And honest to God, this book, Influenced by Robert Cialdini, has been mentioned in more books, the hundreds of books I've read, than any other book. And I think it's probably one of the most mentioned books, because at the end of all my interviews, I ask authors what books have inspired their work and career and so forth. And they very often, a lot of them have mentioned this book. And you've interviewed Dr. Cialdini. I got to interview him about persuasion. Frankly, after interviewing him, I thought, you know what? I think I can hang up my podcasting hat. I think I'm done.
That's it. You've reached the top of the mountain.
The pinnacle. Yeah, I've interviewed Dr. Philip Kotler, the father of modern marketing, and then I've interviewed Dr. Cialdini, and he's actually got an updated version of the book Influence. And with any luck, I'll be interviewing him next month. So, listeners, stay tuned. Nice. If that all comes together. But let me interview him first. Don't you go running to him to interview. It was funny how you all talked about what it was that got him to want to be on your show, and he gets a lot of invitations. And then I thought back to last week when I invited him on the show, and what I said, which may have appealed to him. So, Weapons of Influence. Talk about this. You know, it's funny. Talk about it now. I'm going to keep talking. But at my local university here in Virginia, in Norfolk, Virginia, there was a adjunct professor who is a friend of mine who had been in industry for 40 years, and then he kind of semi-retired, but they asked him to come teach a course. And once a semester, he would have me come in to talk to his students about this book. I was happy to be a stand-in. However marginal for Dr. Robert Cialdini, he couldn't be everywhere. But talk about these principles.
Yeah, well, as you said, this is the only lesson in this book that is only one book
or
one chapter that makes it up, one book. And it's, as you say, it is like the ultimate marketing book where you just like, there was nothing we could mix with it. We were going to mix in persuasion as well as a chapter of this, which is also a fantastic book. Mm-hmm. We did that as like a bonus chapter for the audio book, but in the actual book, we just kept it to the six weapons of influence. As you say, he's got a brand new book out and he's made it seven. He's made the seven levers. We've called it the six weapons. He's changed it to the seven levers of influence. So,
well, he's just playing with you.
It was too late for us to update the book and rewrite and add the seventh one in. So you have to be satisfied with the original six.
You could do a lot worse than just understand these six.
Yeah, that's it. If you get six out of seven, you're doing pretty well, I reckon. He's one of the weapons is reciprocity, and that's just about doing small things for other people, and they want to do things back to you. You know that if a mate buys you a beer, there's almost like an unwritten law that you have to buy them a beer back. And if you don't, everybody remembers their mate that doesn't do the that doesn't buy the beers or who doesn't. If you shout them lunch and the next time they pay, they don't offer to shout you back, then you definitely remember that person. Reciprocity, it's something in our human nature that if someone does something for us, we want to repay the favor. So you need to work out how you can build a little bit of reciprocity into your marketing. Do you want me to go through them all?
Let me add to that one. Are you familiar with Costco? I think they're in Australia. Yeah. Big, you know, warehouse store. They sell food and all kinds of things. And they have tables set up where they'll sample different products. You know, you can try a little bit of this or some. Maybe it's a frozen item that they've cooked for you, and they people will walk up and you can have a free bite. The joke is the Costco diet is you just walk around Costco and eat all the food, and that's the Costco diet. But those companies that are having that food sampled are paying Costco to do that because it moves an enormous amount of merchandise based on this principle. And I can think like years past, my wife bought something there and it just seemed really out of what she would normally buy and it was great. And I said, oh, wow, what prompted you to get this? And she said, oh, they were giving out samples of it.
Too good.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. So yeah, reciprocity and the next one. I mean, I just see these every day.
Yeah, they really are. I just realized if you're talking to him in a month, I don't want to spoil it for your audience.
No,
I
want them please.
To hear it from the marketing guru himself. I can just pick one or two more of my other favorites and leave the rest to the guru himself, I reckon.
Oh, you tease. Okay, talk about social proof. Can you talk about that one?
Yeah,
one of my favorites.
Social proof was going to be the one I picked as well. And I've got a personal story of social proof as well. I don't remember exactly where it was in the book, but you reminded me about it before this interview that we like to do things if we know that other people are doing them.
Was it when you were in Amsterdam?
Like, if you think of like that was the one. I don't know if you want me to go into that story or the more PG stories options that
I've. No, I want you to go into it because I think it's you know, it sinks down to my level. But you didn't actually, you're not really guilty. You didn't realize what was going on. But tell it because it has to do with a little thing I call sex. Please.
Well, social proof is just that idea that if things become hard, if it's hard to make a decision, like if you don't know, should I buy this product? Should I go to this event? Should I eat at this restaurant? They're tough decisions to go through all the calculations in our brain of the pros and cons. It's much easier to defer to the crowd. If lots of other people are doing it, we figure, hey, it must be a good idea. You know, that's why on TV sitcoms, they put that fake laughter underneath because you figure if other people are laughing, it must be funny. Even though you know it's fake, it still works on us. Or you know, at bars and restaurants, if they see the tip jar, if there's a tip jar that's, you know, 40% full, then you're going to put a tip in compared to if it's empty and you think that nobody else is tipping. I know that the US is everybody tips, and in Australia it's not quite like that. But the biggest one that got me, the social proof, I was in Amsterdam. I was with my girlfriend at the time, and we were quite young at the time. And we
come on, you're only 28.
Well,
when I was a lad
back in the day, we must have been 21, 22, and it was our first overseas trip together, and we saw this massive line at the front.
Now, was
we
this thought, the this girlfriend that you met after you read a book about how to pick up girls?
The one and only, actually. that's another chapter altogether about I read a book on how to get a girlfriend, and I got one, the first one I met, and now we're engaged and getting married next year. So
oh,
it worked almost too well, that book.
Wow. Yeah. Now, remember, listener, when I was talking about the ROI of books? I rest my case.
That's all you need to know. That's a magic pill indeed. But this, we're walking around the red light district in Amsterdam, and we saw a massive line, and we thought, well, this is a pretty popular place. We better head in. And there was, you know, 30 people in line. We had to wait there for at least 15, 20 minutes out on the street waiting to get in. We figured this is such a popular place. Everybody's going here. We better head in. And we get inside, and it was only like 20-25% full. There was so much space for everybody who was in line that they could have put everybody in, and it's still been only half full. But we realized that that line was sort of half the point, is that if you saw a line at the front, it must mean it's a super popular place. Everybody wants to get in. It's worth the wait. So we waited. We got in, and it was actually a live sex show. And so it was a couple of people up on stage having sex, and 10 or 15 people sitting in the audience watching on. So we realized that the whole point of this marketing was the perception of social proof. By having people lined up outside, it meant that you weren't the only one that had to walk into this live sex show, that you could say that, well, everybody else is doing it, so I can do it too.
The sex or...
Everything that was involved in that experience.
Yeah, but you know, how many times have we gone into restaurants and seen people cavorting on the floor and having sex? How was the food there, Adam?
I must admit, I did not order any food there. I must admit.
Yeah.
It wasn't dinner and a show. It was just a show for me.
Okay. And she still stayed with you. I guess maybe she realized you didn't know what it was. But for those folks,
complete ignorance, yeah.
I have a lot of listeners in Amsterdam. It's Casa Rosso. I'm looking it up right here. I don't see that they have a website, but apparently it's one of the reviews says, not what we expected. So, eye-opener sex theater, review of Casa Rosso. Okay. Well, that was social proof. There was even the other one that I like, and I'll just mention what it is scarcity. Where, I mean, I see it on Amazon where it'll say 6 items left or hurry now or for some reason on Facebook, which I don't go on Facebook like I should, but I'll look at it and they're really targeting me with all these sweepstakes. Like you can win a truck or a motorcycle or a copy of The Shit They Never Taught You. And I always – my hobby is – entering these things without a purchase, you know, just because I don't have anything else to do, and I don't want them to get over on me. But they're always saying sweepstake ends tonight, you know, or hurry, time is limited. So all the things that the people in the infomercials do, and they are very good at that, they can do that. And as a matter of fact, there was an author on the show a while back, Park Howell, who wrote a book, Brand Bewitchery, and it was very much about storytelling. And he mentioned that he attended a timeshare pitch in Hawaii with his wife, and he's still married to her. I can't believe she didn't leave him for that. But he dragged her to that timeshare pitch so that he could really carefully document exactly what they were doing as it related to these principles from Robert Cialdini's book. So it's very, very interesting. So, Adam, is there anything we didn't talk about that you'd like to share, or is there anything I didn't ask that I should have asked?
Well, I think we covered all the marketing stuff, but as a podcaster myself who does interviews, I wanted to ask you a question as well. And as you know, I think I probably read 60 books a year. I think you got me covered. You're reading over 100 books a year?
Oh no! I read at least one a week because I do one interview a week. Okay. So it's probably maybe more like the 60, 75. It's probably 75 because there are some other things I need to read. And then occasionally an author will stand me up after I've read their book, and I'll include a list of those assholes in this episode's website page. No, I'm kidding. And then actually there's been a few, probably with you all, there's been a few interviews I've done where the interview was really bad and it was like, oh, God. You know, maybe it was a good book, but it was a terrible interview. Or so anyway, there's others that are, the others are out there. I mean, once you kind of get
never make it.
Yeah, book reading muscles going, you actually start reading other things. And I love reading, you know, like history and things like that. So.
Yeah, nice. Well, I guess my question to you is, you read so many fantastic, awesome marketing books with so many phenomenal ideas in them. How do you keep track, and how do you put them into practice, and how do you know, you've in your marketing tool belt, you've got a hammer, you've got a drill, you've got a screwdriver, you've got a chisel. How do you know which situation to pull out which of these seemingly infinite marketing tools that you now have at your disposal?
Well, it's a good question. There's been hundreds of books and, you know, hundreds of bottles of fine Australian wine swirled in there. But what I do is every book, there's certain things I do that I can say, oh, we could use that with this client or that client or, you know, for us or, you know, the agency. I look at that and occasionally I'll do a presentation on some of the key findings, and that helps me kind of bring a lot of them back. Mm. it's funny how every, remember when I read the earlier part here from your book, you talked about it, was no one going to tell me this. Every single book I read, there's something I learn where I'm almost embarrassed to admit I didn't know. So it keeps me reading them. It keeps me humble. And actually, in another book that you all mentioned, I can't remember, in the book you talked about Ryan Holiday's Ego is the Enemy, I believe it was. And the Obstacles non-wanker the Way. Philosophy. Yeah. And but there was one in one of his books, he talks about, I can't remember who it might have been, Greek philosopher, maybe it might have been Aristotle, who said, you know, the more you learn, the more you realize you don't know. And so I try to retain all these things. I keep all the books. I always get a hard copy of the book, and I appreciate you sending me a copy of your book. It's now got all marked up. And I marked up stuff besides the part about the sex show. But I've got post-it notes hanging out and things like that. And because I read the book and I read the physical book, there's something about it that just sticks in my head. When I've had to read a book on a tablet, I just don't retain any of it. So I don't know. It's a good question. I don't have a complete answer there. I still have a list of all the books. And almost every book that's been on the show, I look back on it and I can remember a handful of things that I learned that I hadn't realized before. So that's a good non-answer. I'll be running for Congress here in the United States.
I'm totally the same. I'm with the physical books only. The e-books, the digital versions just don't do it for me. The physical book is what I need to really get those lessons in. And as you say, I think that one good way is always thinking of the direct applications. You know, as you say, you think, oh, this client might be able to use this, or I might be able to use this technique. And then, of course, the synthesis and the combination of putting all the different ideas together is probably what then makes it stick a lot more. But it's there's just so much out there. Ultimately, at the end of the day, I guess for us, as you said, the more you know, the more you know that you don't know, that there's just an infinite mass of ideas out there, and we're hungry for more. We're curious for more.
Yeah, and I guess if I were doing this podcasting thing right, I should write a book like you guys have done where I've tried to document all the key points. But I'm too busy reading these books to
well, that was going to be my next question is, when's your book coming out?
Yeah, but I know what I'm going to call it. Yeah. I'm going to call it The Marketing Book. Get it?
I get it.
And then I could update it every once in a while. It would be a good thing to do. And I think if I did write a book or somehow did a better job of documenting all these things, I'd be able to fit them together. But, you know, there was a book on the show a while back by Daryl Amey, for instance, The Revenue Growth Engine. And I really liked it. And I'll include a link to that interview on this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. And I remember mentioning to him in the book, his book really ties together a lot of the marketing principles and issues and challenges that I've had or we've had in the past and where a lot of companies go wrong. So I mentioned that, like, every section of that book, there were a dozen other books that came to mind. In other words, like, each section brought to mind several others. So it was like a super concentrated book. And it kind of got me thinking, like, this might be helpful, but I don't know. I'm not sure. So it's interesting, though, that you read the physical book. I'm the same way. I mark it up, and I'm sure the psychologist could explain to us what is going on when we're processing information on a screen rather than a book. I just know that on a screen, you tend to scan, and on a book, it's probably using more of your brain to digest the information.
Yeah. I think it's just like a different category. You're used to using your digital screens for other things, whereas the book is the book. You know that you go in there to learn, and you know that the whole point is to get something out of it. That's my guess anyway.
So were there any other questions for me?
Well, you've already named your book, which is a good and important first step. I look forward to reading that book at some point.
Has to be at least 677 pages.
That's the minimum. Actually, you should probably set the goals a little bit lower. In hindsight, I wish we wrote a shorter book, but we couldn't help ourselves. There's so many great books out there.
This is such an incredible project that you all have done, though.
We had a year effectively of completely changed routines where we had found a lot more spare time and less travel and less commuting. So it kind of worked out in our favor that we were able to dedicate so much time to putting this bad boy together.
Mm. Yeah. Well, bravo. There was something else you were going to ask when I so rudely interrupted you.
No, they were my main ones. The book, the how do you remember so much stuff? Because I am, as I said, I've been listening to this show for years, and every time I pick up another little gem or another nugget from a book that I haven't read or an author that I haven't heard of before that inspires me, then I just think there's so many ideas. How do we possibly keep track of them all? And I think it's a question without an answer. I think it's an ever-evolving process and just looking for ways that you can put those ideas into action.
Well, congratulations on this. It's quite an accomplishment. I'm now going to go on. Well, I've already started reading other parts of it. And I've got other books I'm supposed to read. But dang you and the other Adam. So actually, you guys have nicknames. You're Ashto and he's Jonesy, right?
That's right. We figured Adam and Adam was just too confusing with who's Adam and who's the other Adam.
Right. So the book is The Shit They Never Taught You, What You Can Learn from Books. The authors are Adam Ashton and Adam Jones. Adam, thank you very much for joining us for a special bonus episode of the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great to chat and honored to be a guest on your show.